Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to the first of the Friday lunchtime lectures for Lent term. We are delighted to be beginning this term with our guest for today. Professor Balakrishnan Rajgopal is Professor of Law and Development at MIT and founder of MIT's Program on Human Rights and Justice and also its Displacement Research and Action Network. A leading voice on third world approaches to international law, Professor Rajgopal is, amongst his other publications, author of the wonderful International Law from Below, Developments, Social Movements, and Third World Resistance that was published by CUP. If I may add a personal note here, this book had come out when I was a law student and was extremely formative for my thinking and my cohort's thinking around the ways in which it was possible to think and write about international law. Professor Rajgopal has had also an extremely distinguished practice career. He served for many years with the UN, with the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights in Cambodia. He was Human Rights Advisor to the World Commission on Dams and has consulted with UNDP as well as several other UN agencies, international organizations, and leading NGOs on human rights and international legal issues. As many of you will know, he is currently the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing, and I believe his talk today will be directed to some work that corresponds to this role. Just before I hand over the mic to Professor Rajgopal, a reminder that there will be time at the end for you to ask questions. If you have a question, please use the Q&A box to type it in, and I will read out the questions as they come in. Now, without further ado, welcome Professor Rajgopal, and the mic is yours.
Thank you very much, Surabhi. And it's a delight for me to participate in this event. And my good New Year wishes to all of you. Hopefully we will have a much better, more happy and less disruptive year going forward. I'm really glad to join this seminar and share some ideas, essentially drawing from a recent report that I submitted to the UN Human Rights Council on basically taking stock of the 20 years of the mandate on the right to adequate housing, and then outlining some of what I consider to be the key challenges and priorities for the right to adequate housing in the coming years. As many of you may know, special rapporteurs are independent experts who are appointed by the UN Human Rights Council for a period of 3 years, extended by another three for a total of 6 years. And every year you are required to write two substantive reports, one report to the UN General Assembly in the fall and one report to the UN Human Rights Council in the spring. And these are called thematic reports. The thematic reports basically give you a chance to sort of spell out your view of what you think are the main challenges and concerns that the global community should be focusing its attention on. That's basically sort of what I have been trying to do since I was appointed in May of 2020. Of course, we have other work that we do as special rapporteurs as well. A crucial part of the work that we do has to do with the development of guidance or standards under international law. So all my predecessors, for example, under the right to housing mandate, which was actually established in 2000, although under the UN Human Rights, the Subcommission on Human Rights, the right to housing mandate was begun in 1993, and Justice Rajinder Sachar was appointed, former Chief Justice of the Delhi High Court, to begin the very important work of thinking about the legal standards that apply to in this area. And then from 2000, under the UN Human Rights Council, more directly, it was still the Human Rights Commission, but the idea was to consolidate it more as a special rapporteur on right to housing, and Milun Kothari was appointed as a first rapporteur, and then was followed by Raquel Rolnick, and then Leilani Farha, and then by me. The all my predecessors have made important contributions to the to clarify the normative content of the right to adequate housing by developing guidance to address particular issues. For example, on development-based evictions and displacement by Milun Kothari, security of tenure for the urban poor by Raquel Rolnick, and implementation on the right to adequate housing by Leilani Farha. The ability of the rapporteur to respond quickly to unforeseen and unprecedented developments also is very important, particularly as we saw in the run up to the, in the, you know, circumstances surrounding the COVID-19 guidance notes and other instruments that were issued as a response to the pandemic. Both Leilani Farha, as well as later myself, have pushed some of the standards by summarizing them in the form of guidance notes having to do with the COVID-19 pandemic and the right to housing, which has been, from what we are told by both states as well as civil society actors, quite useful for many. The standards that we developed in the guidance notes also inform my first thematic report to the UN General Assembly, which contained key recommendations to mitigate the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the right to adequate housing and to address longstanding housing exclusion and discrimination that became quite visible during the crisis, when it became quite obvious that, you know, while everybody is affected by the crisis, some people are more affected than others, and they tend to be people who belong to racial and ethnic minorities, women, indigenous people, LGBTQ communities, and so on and so forth. A second major part of a special rapporteur's contribution has to do with the thematic reports. As I said, the mandate has submitted 33 thematic reports to the General Assembly in the 20 years of the mandate to the General Assembly and the Human Rights Council, addressing various aspects related to the realization of the right to housing, ranging from forced evictions, homelessness, the right to housing of women and persons with disabilities, to the issue of financialization of housing, which is very important for questions such as affordability, which is a major issue for most people who live in cities these days. Affordability is an issue that I'm going to tackle as a major issue in one of my own reports going forth. These reports have contributed to raise awareness and bring to the attention of governments, civil society actors, and others obstacles and evolving challenges, and often have been cited in court decisions and other documents as well. A third, so part of the work of a special rapporteur has to do with country visits to particular sites. The mandate has conducted 34 country visits since it was established. These visits provided an opportunity to engage in a direct dialogue with states at various levels and other stakeholders and assess the implementation of the right to adequate housing on the ground. Because often states say one thing, but then when you go and actually see what's going on the ground and listen to people, you find that, well, the reality is something else. Several states visited by special rapporteur have used such visits as an opportunity to advance their own legal and policy reforms aimed at protecting and promoting the right to adequate housing. For example, Mexico, Kenya, Chile, and New Zealand have all advanced, you know, versions of right to housing legislation. Most recently, you know, Canada has advanced a right to housing legislation as well, often influenced by the work of the rapporteur. I hope to resume my country visits as soon as possible. I must say that because of COVID, I have not been able to carry out country visits thus far, and therefore I can only say I've been a remote rapporteur in the 2 years that I've been doing my work. But virtual meetings can never replace the essential value of personal interaction during country visits, and of seeing and properly understanding what's going on the ground and understanding the realities and challenges that both public authorities and rights holders face. a fourth very important part of the work that I personally didn't appreciate, you know, as much before I was appointed, is the question of communications, dealing with complaints and issuing public statements. Since 1st December 2010, the Special Rapporteur has sent more than 385 communications to states and other actors. Since assuming office, I have devoted additional efforts to respond to information brought to my attention, as there has been a sharp increase of alleged housing rights violations during the COVID-19 pandemic. Because as you can imagine, as people were told to stay at home during the COVID-19 pandemic to shelter from the virus, it became quite obvious that home was basically seen as the sort of the front line in the fight against the pandemic. So if you didn't have access to a safe home, then that became a matter of life and death. I have also embarked on a more proactive approach to addressing housing rights issues related to business enterprises or internationally financed development projects. The communication procedures of the special procedures, I think, is one of the most accessible and fast international human rights complaints mechanisms, although, of course, constantly challenged by lack of adequate staffing and other resources, given the number of complaints we receive. But so because of that, we can only respond to a fraction of the communications received. So therefore, there is a strategic approach to which ones you respond to. In addition to communications, public statements also are very essential to fulfill early warning capacities of the UN. And my report highlights several recent examples in which either communications or public statements have been quite successful in contributing to the prevention of imminent housing rights violations. For example, 2021, there was a case involving Bahamas that I've cited in my report. Those are some of the sort of the broad sort of outlines of the record of the housing mandate in the last 20 years. Let me now turn to some future priorities. What is it that I intend to focus my attention on? Of course, you know, when I was appointed, COVID-19 pandemic was already a reality. It was raging. It was May of 2020. So my first thematic report to the General Assembly called attention to the disproportionate impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on marginalized communities, including racial, ethnic, and other minorities, women and children, the fragility of temporary measures to secure right to housing, including eviction moratoria, which were fast sort of expiring in many countries, and the continuing evidence of a high number of forced evictions during the pandemic. The pandemic, of course, has continued since the time when I submitted the report, and will leave us with profound challenges for the realization of not simply right to adequate housing, but of all economic, social, and cultural rights in for many years to come. Home has never been more central to health, and indeed life and death, as I said, during the pandemic. But the rebuilding path ahead also appears very fragile, and there must be a rededication to a human rights-oriented response to the pandemic based on sustainable development goals, with housing at the heart of the recovery, as I have tried to advocate. A second major focus of my mandate is on discrimination and combined with that spatial segregation. Now, discrimination related to housing is an important matter, which has not lost its urgency since the mandate was first established in the year 2000 with an explicit reference to non-discrimination in its official title, which is usually not the case with all the economic and social rights mandates, where you don't have the term non-discrimination mentioned in the title of the mandate, and housing is unique in that. Taking this issue seriously, I decided to focus my reports to the General Assembly and the Human Rights Council on discrimination and spatial segregation. The report on discrimination was submitted. Now the report on spatial segregation will be submitted this March where I'll be presenting it to the members of the Human Rights Council, and the text will be available. Discrimination is at the heart of the denial of the right to adequate housing as racial and ethnic minorities, indigenous people, women, older persons, LGBTQ communities, migrant workers, refugees, so many others face tremendous barriers in accessing adequate housing. Spatial segregation often exists in parallel with highly unequal discriminatory access to a range of human rights, including, for example, other economic and social rights like right to water, sanitation, work, education, healthcare, or other so-called civil and political rights, such as physical integrity or movement. Disparities in access to all public services in security and policing are not uncommon in many cities and human settlements. Too often, the degree of protection and access to water, electricity, education, healthcare, or even security depends on where one lives. And this deep entrenching of the separated living between communities is a condition of modern living in the current conditions of 21st century that I want to capture through the focus on spatial segregation. Discrimination and segregation are entrenching divisions, I feel, between communities and making it more difficult to make meaningful progress towards the achievement of the right to adequate housing and other human rights. The rise of global movements for racial justice during the last decade, including the United States, clearly illustrates the need to tackle the vast disparities between poor communities and very wealthy, and between racial, ethnic, and religious groups. States have an important role in curbing housing discrimination and addressing spatial segregation through legislation and policies. The next sort of challenge that I'd like to focus my attention on, which will be the report to the General Assembly later this year, is on the climate crisis. The climate crisis, of course, is one of the most critical challenges facing the right to adequate housing and all economic, social, and cultural rights. The question is how these rights can be realized in a manner which does not worsen, but mitigates climate change. It is therefore essential to imagine housing in ways that do not depend on increasing material consumption and increased appropriation of space and nature. Housing rights advocates have advocated for minimal floor sizes to avoid overcrowding and ensure decent living conditions thus far. They have done so rightly, in my view, but it is also time to think about wasteful and unsustainable housing undermining the enjoyment of rights for others and contributing to the current climate crisis. In the coming years, I hope to focus on other priorities. One of them is the question of the right to housing and its nexus to humanitarian law and humanitarian response. Under international criminal law, some systematic or widespread violations of the right to housing, such as forced displacement and wanton destruction of housing, may lead to state responsibility and individual criminal accountability. In addition, the increasingly urban character of displacement poses challenges to the relationship between displaced communities and host communities and to the provision of infrastructure and services. A search for durable solutions in respect to shelter and housing must therefore emphasize security of tenure and area-based approaches, be inclusive, and emphasize as well the broader needs of the wider host communities in which displaced persons live. And I hope to have enough ability to focus on these and other issues. After that, I would like to turn my attention to the question of the need for better and more detailed international guidelines on resettlement and relocation, similar to the guidelines that I mentioned my predecessors have developed. The absence of such international guidelines on resettlement and relocation results in widely varying approaches to eligibility criteria for project-affected people, compensation for loss of land, for example, and housing rights, standards of due process, consultation, participation, and consent requirements for relocation and site selection, or benefit sharing arrangements. The result is that resettlement relocation records of too many countries are in serious breach of human rights law and defeat the development objectives, including sustainable development goals, which states have set for themselves. Now, resettlement and relocation are critical now, not simply because there is an enormous number of people being moved around because of development-induced displacement and conflict, but also because of the increasing need for people to be relocated because of climate change. So it's very important that we develop these guidelines. There is also a need to rethink land governance, which is my next priority, as it is central for the realization of the right to adequate housing. Now, land use in much of the world used to be based on plural mutual understandings between neighboring groups and those who live together. This has been eliminated by key legal and planning tools deployed by states, such as eminent domain, also known as compulsory acquisition under the laws of many countries. The erasure of plural tenure arrangements by statist regimes and land grabbing by agro and other large businesses has undermined security of tenure of land and contributed to forced evictions and displacement, thus undermining the right to adequate housing. So finally, a priority that I'd like to sort of focus on is the role of private and public actors in ensuring accessible and affordable housing. As I mentioned earlier, the question of affordability has to be tackled front and center. In many countries, renters find it difficult to afford housing at a reasonable cost. That's the brutal truth. At the same time, the stock of social affordable public housing for low-income households has often decreased or has been sold to private actors, as for example, in some parts of the United Kingdom. Private actors, the developers, financiers, credit institutions, and intermediate market institutions that manage real estate transactions must respect the right to housing. Similarly, the performance of public housing providers, including specialized housing agencies, which assume in many countries semi-public-private forms, needs also to be closely assessed. And as many of you know, if you've been following the debates recently in Berlin, the question of affordability is central for livelihood and for living in many of the cities around the world. And I hope that, you know, with my report, I can contribute to this ongoing global movement. So those are some of the broad sort of priorities that I hope to pursue during my remaining years of my mandate. Some priorities I've already tried to sort of tackle by issuing reports on them. And I welcome a chance to talk about these in more detail or answer any questions. So let me maybe stop with that and turn it over to Surabhi. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Professor Rajagopal. That was actually really informative, and it's really exciting to think of the various directions in which you're taking the mandate. So I'm looking forward to the series of reports that will also come out in addition to the work that you have done already.